Krishnam Krishnam Vidur Param Tantam Natu Brahmataya Mune Guna Pravaho Paramas Tasam Gunatiyam Katam Sri Parikshit Uvacha Krishnam Vidu Param Kantam Natu Brahmataya Mune Guna Pravaho Paramas Tasam guna diyam katam Krishnam vidu param kantam Natu brahmataya mune Guna pravaho paramas Tasam guna diyam katam
Param kantam
Krishnam vidu param kantam
Natu brahmataya mune
Natu brahmataya mune
Guna pravaho paramas
Guna pravaho paramas
Tasam guna diyam katam
Tasam guna diyam katam
Sri Parikshit Uvacha
Sri Parikshit Uvacha
Sri Parikshit Uvacha.
Sri Parikshit said.
Krishnam.
Krishnam.
Lord Krishna.
Lord Krishna.
Vidu.
Vidu.
They knew.
They knew.
Param.
Param.
Only. Kantam.
Kantam.
As their beloved.
As their beloved.
Na.
Na.
Not.
Not.
Tu.
Tu.
But. Brahmataya,
as the absolute truth.
Mune,
O
sage. Shukadev.
Guna,
of the three modes of material nature.
Pravaha,
of the mighty current.
Uparama,
the cessation.
Tasam,
for them.
Gunadiyam,
whose mentality
was caught up
in those words.
Katam,
how? Translation of Prabhupada by the followers of Srila Prabhupada. Sri Parikshit Maharaj said, O sage, the gopis knew Krishna only as their lover, not as the supreme absolute truth. So how could these girls, their minds caught up in the waves of the modes of nature, free themselves from material attachment? Translation responsibly. Sri Pariksit Maharaj said, O sage, the gopis knew Krishna only as their lover, not as the supreme absolute truth. So how could these girls, their minds caught up in the waves of the modes of nature, free themselves from material attachment? Purport. King Pariksit was sitting in an assembly of great sages and other important personalities, listening to the words of Shukadev Goswami. According to Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti, as Shukadev began speaking of the gopis' conjugal love for Krishna, the king noticed the expressions on the faces of some of the more materialistic persons present there, and realized the doubt lurking in their hearts. Therefore, although the king thoroughly knew the purport of Shukadev's words, he presented himself as experiencing personal doubt so that he could eradicate the doubt of others. That is why he asked this question. Omagyan Timananda Sya Gyananjana Shalakaya Chakshurun Militam Yena Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha Sri Chaitanya Manovishtam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kadamayam Dadati Swa Padantikam Panchakalpatarubhyascha Kripa Sindubhyevacha Patitanam Pavanebhyo Vaishnavebhyo Namonamaha Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityanando Sri Advaita Gadadhara Sri Vasadi Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. So it's pointed out here by Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur, who is one of our great acharyas, that Pariksit Maharaj was asking this question not because he was in doubt, but rather because he was doubting the consciousness of the various sages in the assembly. It's not that everyone in the assembly at while Shukadev Goswami was speaking to Maharaj Pariksit was on an equal level of realization. So because the level of realization was different between the different sages, then Shukadev Goswami was speaking in a particular way. And this is actually the theme of the entire Srimad Bhagavatam. It is not spoken, it is spoken categorically or systematically or gradually in terms of revelation of the Absolute Truth. In other words, Shukadev Goswami is an expert preacher. So one, we have to learn as preachers, as representatives of the disciplic succession, we have to learn how to present our philosophy in such a way that it will benefit people the most. Now, if Shukadev Goswami had have gone straight to the subject matter of the 10th canto, then it would not have been as beneficial for all the sages who were assembled, right? Because they were not ready to hear directly the 10th canto. So the Srimad Bhagavatam prepares us to hear the 10th canto, right? That's why it's spoken the way it is. That's why it's spoken systematically. And Prabhupada points this out, that the Srimad Bhagavatam does not directly go to Krishna's pastimes, but rather one must study it if he is serious from the beginning. It has to be studied categorically, if you're serious. Prabhupada said, you can read it here and you can read it there, like that. But he said, if you are a serious student, then you must listen the way that Pariksit Maharaj listened to Shukadev Goswami. And if you do that, you will get the result of hearing Srimad Bhagavatam. And what is the result of hearing? Yeah, Krishna.
Love for Krishna.
Love for Krishna. Yeah. Ultimately, that's what's there.
All the bad things in the heart of being
removed. Yeah, that's nice. So Prabhupada says in the introduction of the Bhagavatam, He says that if you study the first nine cantos systematically and properly, you'll be a God-realized soul by the end of the ninth canto. And you have to be a God-realized soul if you want to understand the tenth canto. Right? Because the tenth canto is directly speaking about Krishna in his most intimate, it is the most intimate revelation of God. It is the most intimate revelation of the pastimes of the spiritual world, the eternal pastimes of Krishna, of God. So if you want to understand this, then you have to be purified by hearing the other nine cantos systematically. So therefore, when we preach, we have to preach according to the level of understanding of the audience. Because the tenth canto is the higher subject matter. But if people come in here for the Sunday feast, right, and you just start speaking about, you know, Krishna as he is in Vrindavan directly, if you go straight to that level, then it will be very difficult for the people who are hearing it. Although you are speaking the absolute truth, but the people you're speaking to are not ready to hear it like that yet. So therefore, we must present the philosophy very expertly. In other words, we must give a systematic progression of the philosophy in order for people to benefit properly. So Shukadeva Goswami, he was sitting not with half a dozen people who were battling to stay awake. It was quite different. You see, modern Bhagavatam classes, you have maybe 5-6 people, maybe 20, some mornings, right? And there's devotees like, right? It's like a challenge to keep people awake. If you can keep people awake, it's a good class. Because it's difficult to keep people awake, even in Kali Yuga. But Shukadeva Goswami, he wasn't sitting with a bunch of people who were just sitting there, nodding off while he was speaking. They were self-realized souls, the majority of them, right? And they were listening to Shukadeva Goswami with rapt attention, very intently. But still, he did not go straight to Krishna's pastimes as they are in the 10th canto. He spoke very systematically and progressively to elevate their consciousness. Right? And that's the way the Krishna consciousness must be presented, and that's the way the Prabhupada presented Krishna consciousness. Very systematically, very categorically, in order to elevate everyone's consciousness to the proper platform. Because if you can get to the proper platform, then you can understand Krishna properly. So, what's taking place here is that Parikshit Maharaj is feeling great ecstasy in hearing about Krishna's pastimes in Vrindavan. Right? He's feeling ecstatic by hearing these pastimes. But he's not alone. He's not the only one sitting there with Shukadeva Goswami. So he looks around and he notices that not everyone has the same level of consciousness. So therefore, while he is looking around, he sees that Shukadeva Goswami has just began to speak about Krishna with the gopis. Right? And some of the personalities in the assembly have a look on their face, because the face is the index of the mind. So they have a look on their face as if these pastimes between Krishna and the gopis have some mundane contamination of the modes of passion, and therefore are somewhat contaminated by material lust. So he sees that actually they have this understanding. And this is the danger, and this is why we are warned about this part of the Bhagavatam. The warning is given many, many, many times. Prabhupada was very careful in speaking about this. In the Leelamrita, you read in Prabhupada's Leelamrita, that there's one time in India, and Prabhupada is staying in the house of some life members. And then, straight after Mangalati in the morning, at about 5 in the morning, the husband and wife, they're a little bit elderly. No, they're not even like young people like that. You can't put the fingers in the mouth because it's considered contaminated like that, because you have to wash your hands like that, so. So in the temple, at least don't do it, but if you do it outside, then you have to wash your hands like that. So they were like an elderly couple, and they came to Prabhupada straight after Mangalati, right? And they said to Prabhupada, Swamiji, please tell us about Rasa Lila. And Prabhupada said, no, this is a very elevated thing like that. And they were very insistent. Sometimes Indians are very insistent. If you've been to India, you might know some Indians are very insistent. So So they were saying to Prabhupada, like, again and again, no, Prabhupada, please, we want to hear Rasa Leela. Prabhupada said, no, this is elevated thing, like that. And they're very insistent, they kept going, like a more of an elderly couple, you know, husband and wife, wanting to hear about Rasa Leela. And they said, Prabhupada, you know, please tell us to hear it. We want to hear it. And Prabhupada said, what did they say to Prabhupada? I can't remember exactly how they said it. Prabhupada, in the end, he became a little bit firm and a little bit angry with them in order to check them. And he said, you may be qualified to hear it, but I'm not qualified to speak it. Right? Because Prabhupada was qualified to speak it, but they were not qualified to hear it. Because they wanted to hear it in some mundane way. So Prabhupada would not speak it to them. Right? So Sugata Goswami, actually, if you look at the Srimad Bhagavatam, there's 18,000 verses. Right, there's 335 chapters. There's only 5 chapters, well, there's a little more, there's 6 or 7 chapters which deal with Krishna's pastimes with the gopis. That's not a lot, considering you're talking about 335 chapters. That's not a large percentage of the Bhagavatam. Sukadeva Goswami, in terms of his eternal relationship with Krishna, is the parrot of Krishna in the spiritual world. He is in Madhurya Rasa himself. He is relishing this. That's why he's sitting on the Vyasasana in the assembly at amongst all the different sages, because he is the most elevated person in consciousness. He has the deepest realizations of God. Right? He is the most elevated devotee in the assembly, yet he doesn't speak at length about Krishna's pastimes with the gopis, even though he realizes them more than anyone else. So this is because he doesn't want to... he knows that the listeners are not fully qualified to hear it. And also, it is pointed out by the Acharyas, it's interesting because in terms of Krishna and in terms of Krishna's relationships with his devotees, it is described that the rasas gradually elevate, right? From Shanta to Dasya to Sakya to Vatsalya to Madhurya. Madhurya is considered the highest rasa, the most complete rasa. It has all the other rasas contained within it. It's the most satisfying relationship with Krishna. And the gopis in particular have Madhurya Ras. Their relationship with Krishna is the most satisfying, even more than the queens in Dwarka, who are also in Madhurya Ras. Right? So this relationship with the gopis and Krishna is the most pleasing to Krishna, the most ecstatic. And of all the gopis, Srimati Radharani is the highest or the most beloved of Krishna out of all gopis. And the Acharyas point out all the way through their commentaries, right, that Radharani, Jiva Goswami says in the beginning of the Bhagavatam in his commentary, he said Radharani is so complete that Krishna does not even need anyone else to be fully satisfied. Right? We're just there to, you know, to assist in some way, right? But Radharani herself can fully satisfy Krishna. That is her potency. Right? She has so much love for Krishna. She can fully satisfy Krishna, completely, right? All of us are just there to, you know, increase the rasa. That's our position, right? But it's interesting because Sukadeva does not mention Radharani's name directly, right? And he had full revelation of that the highest stage of love of Godhead was the relationship between Radha and Krishna. And yet he doesn't say anything directly about Radharani. He indirectly mentions her name. He says, Araja. Right, he indirectly, a few times, mentions her name, indirectly. And the Acharyas point out the reason that he doesn't directly mention Radharani's name is because he would have gone into a trance. Right? If he hadn't said Radharani's name directly, he would have just gone into a trance, feeling ecstasy, and then the Bhagavatam would not be finished. You know, what about Canto 11? What about Canto 12? You know, so the Bhagavatam needed to be finished. So he checked himself from speaking directly about Radharani, and he doesn't go into great details about the, like, you know, even it's said that these 5 chapters of the Bhagavatam are the highest revelations of the Srimad Bhagavatam, but he doesn't really go into a lot of detail. Right? The Goswamis go into far more detail, far more detail. Like Govinda Lilamrita and Krishna Bhavanamrita by Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami and Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur, they go into far more detail. They go into the Ashtakaliya Lila, into the eightfold daily pastimes of Krishna, in a very intricate and detailed explanation of what takes place in those pastimes. Right? So he doesn't speak so much. So the point is that Sukadeva Goswami was only presenting because according to the audience's level of understanding. So the point is that when we preach Krishna consciousness, we must preach according to the level of the audience. Right? If the audience is not ready to hear something more into it, then you should not present it like that, because they'll misconstrue it. Even some of the sages here are misconstruing what's going on. Now we should understand that there is no contamination of the modes of nature in Krishna's pastimes. Krishna's pastimes on the platform of Vishuddha Sattva. Right? What does Vishuddha Sattva mean? What is Vishuddha Sattva?
Transcendental goodness.
Yeah, pure. Yeah, like transcendental, right? Shuddha means pure, right? Vishuddha means most pure, right? And Sattva means goodness. It's beyond the modes of material nature. All of Krishna's pastimes are in Vishuddha Sattva. Janma, karma, chame, divyam. Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, my janma, when I appear, and my karma, everything I do when I appear, is transcendental, right? It is not material. But people misconstrue that Krishna's relationship with the gopis is material lust, right? But the acharyas go to great length to point out that it is not material lust, right? To great length in their purports, in their commentaries. And a question that can be asked, right, which people do ask, some devotees, because we're reading this most intimate section of the Bhagavatam now. Since the temple's been here, since 1975 or so, right? I'll just see. 75, 79. Yeah. So this is the second time they're going through the Bhagavatam. Right, second time, like the Canto 1 to 12, right? And then they've gone back to Canto 1. I remember when I joined in 1989, it was Canto 11. That's what we're on. And then we went to Canto 12 and then we started again. Now we're nearly gone through it again. So this is the second time we're going through it, right? Now, last time they went through it, right, the devotees jumped over Canto 10, right, last time around, right, because they felt that Canto 10 was too, like, elevated. So devotees do question. Devotees do say, should we even study Canto 10? Right, because there is great warning surrounding Canto 10. It must be studied in the correct way, right? If you study the 10th canto, right, with the wrong consciousness, then you'll get the wrong result, right? If you read about the pastimes of Krishna and the gopis, which are being explained here, but you have material consciousness, too much of the mode of passion, and too much lust, too much material consciousness, then what will happen is that your lust will increase. So therefore it is said, do not read it, right? But if it is read in the right way and studied in the right way, meaning that the devotees have the right mentality when reading it, if they're preparing their consciousness properly by understanding the presentation of the acharyas properly, then it will have the opposite effect. Right? By reading the pastime of Krishna and the gopis, the heart will be cleansed of material lust. Right? And it's interesting, if you read these five chapters, because we've said in previous classes, these five chapters, the 10th canto, like the deity is considered to be, the Bhagavatam is considered to be like the deity. Cantos 1 and 2 are his lotus feet, then canto 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. 9 is his neck, right? 10 is the face. 11 is the forehead, and 12 is the crown of the deity, right? So this is the face of Krishna. The face is the most beautiful part of the person, right? We don't look at someone's hand, you know? Oh, you have a beautiful hand. It's a really beautiful hand. I can just look at your hand. You know, you don't look at someone's hand, you look at their face. The face is where the expression of the person is. So the 10th canto is Krishna's face, and it says chapters 29 to 33 are Krishna's smile. And when someone smiles, their face becomes most beautiful. Right? So therefore this is like the most intimate part of Krishna's pastimes. Right? And it says at the end, the last thing Sukadeva Goswami says at the end of the five chapters, right, when he gets to the end of the 33rd chapter, the last verse he says is that if one hears, these pastimes of Krishna and the gopis, the conjugal pastimes, right, with purified heart, purified consciousness, it will remove material lust. Right? All the material desire for sex life will be removed. Right? Because then we'll see that the real adi-ras means the original rasa. Right? Everything in this world is just a perverted reflection of the original rasas. Right? Everything in this world. And what's the topmost thing in this world? What's the topmost pleasure everyone looks for in this world? Is relationship between men and women. Right? So that is a reflection of the highest thing in the material world. What is the highest thing in the material world is the lowest thing in the... Did I say it the wrong way? Yeah. Okay. We'll just turn that around. So the highest thing in the spiritual world is the lowest thing in the material world. Right? Because Krishna says in the 15th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita that the material world is like a banyan tree. It's a reflection of the original tree. So the highest part of the tree is the lowest part in the reflection. Right? So what is the highest thing in the spiritual world? Madhurya ras, right? Love between Krishna and his paramour. But what sort of madhurya ras? In madhurya ras, there was two categories: swakya and parakya. Right? Swakya means with Krishna's wives. Right? Swa means your own. Right? Belongs to you. Right? The wife belongs to the husband. At least in Vedic times, that was true. It's not anymore. But in Vedic times it was true, the wife belonged to the husband, right? So, the wife belongs to the husband, but in Parakya Ras, right, which is Krishna's pastimes with the gopis, there is no marriage. At least there's no official external marriage ceremony. So therefore, the relationship is not bound, right? Husband and wife are bound, right? So there's less excitement. You know, you come home, your wife's there, the husband comes home, big deal. What do you do tomorrow? The wife, you know, husband goes out work, comes back home, wife's there, big deal. Right? It's not really that exciting, actually. So, what's more exciting or more pleasing for Krishna is to have the relationship of Parakya Ras with the gopis. Right? It is more exciting because there is no guarantee that Krishna and the gopis will meet. Right? Whenever Krishna has to try to meet with the gopis, there's so much obstacles, so many obstacles which are there impeding their meeting. They have to go through so much to come together every day. They come together during the day and they come together during the night every single day in eternity. Right? But there's so many obstacles and that increases the rasa unlimitedly. But from a material moralistic point of view, in terms of material dharma, it's abominable. And that's also why Krishna is sometimes misunderstood and criticized in India. He is abominable. Right? He is the god of mundane sex. Right? Because he's just interested in affairs with other men's wives. That's abominable. So that thing which is the lowest thing, that's the lowest thing in the material world. The lowest thing is to have an extramarital affair. Right? That is considered the worst thing in Vedic culture. Right? But in the spiritual world, it is the highest thing. Right? So therefore, it shows that in the spiritual world, it must be completely pure. It must be beyond the modes of material nature. Otherwise, how could it be so exalted? Right? It's so exalted to the point that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, who is the most perfect sannyasi, the most renounced, material renounced personality of all time in existence, although he has completely no interest whatsoever in anything material, he fully absorbs his consciousness in the relationship between the love between Radha and Krishna and the gopis. Which shows that if someone is completely materially disinterested, like Shukadeva Goswami, right, who is completely materially disinterested, yet their consciousness is so attracted to the pristine love between the Radha and Krishna and the gopis, it shows that it must be beyond the modes of material nature. It's not an ordinary event which is taking place. So therefore, devotees do question, and it's not wrong to question, should we hear these pastimes? Right? And Prabhupada did not say that we should not hear these pastimes, but Prabhupada did point out that they must be heard in the proper way. In other words, the motivation must be correct. Right? You must not be hearing them for material sense enjoyment. You should not be listening to them in order to increase your lust. Right? If that is the motivation, then go back to the first canto. Go back to the beginning of the Bhagavad Gita, second chapter, and learn that you're not your body. Right? And then, if you understand all of these lessons, that's the point. As we study the Bhagavatam categorically, as we go through the first nine cantos, you have to imbibe each lesson into your consciousness. Right? So that when you get to the end of the ninth canto, you should be free from material attachments. Right? All the different lessons the Bhagavatam teaches us as we go through, if they actually, if we realise those things, then when we get to the 10th canto, we'll be qualified to actually understand Krishna's pastimes of the gopis. At this point in time, although we are studying the 10th canto because we're studying the Bhagavatam systematically, we're not actually qualified to hear the pastimes in the sense that we don't actually see Krishna as a purely spiritual personality, because we don't see ourselves as a purely spiritual personality. And that is the problem with our consciousness. We don't see ourselves as being purely spiritual, right? But it's an interesting point to consider. We are purely spiritual, right? We're not material, right? Even though every day, like if I ask you who you are and you ask me who I am, right? I'll say I'm a man and women will say they're women, right? But that's a relative truth, right? That's not an absolute truth. That's not an absolute statement. I'm going to say I'm a man. I'm a husband of this particular woman, I'm a father of this particular child, I'm born in this particular family, right? But that's just a relative truth, right? In, say, 80 years' time, that, what I call the truth, right, that relative truth which I say I am, that will completely change, right? In my next lifetime, I'll be some, you know, housewife in Ireland, right, with six kids, you know, running around, right? And then I'll think that is the absolute truth, right? And then that will change again. Right? And then I'll become a pig in Stockholm, right? And then I'll think that's the truth, right? And then again and again and again. So the point is that in order to understand the absolute truth, the Param Satyam, which is what the Bhagavatam is speaking of, particularly this part of the 10th canto is speaking about, then we must get to the platform of understanding the absolute truth. And the beginning of that sambandha is that we are not the body. We are the soul. We are spiritual by nature. And if you understand you are spiritual by nature, then you can understand Krishna's spiritual activities, which are not mundane. So, the acharyas do go to great lengths to point out that these pastimes are not material, they are spiritual. Right? So, once again, devotees sometimes ask, should we read these pastimes? Right. Prabhupada did not prohibit it. Right? He didn't say you can't, but he did say you must read them in the right mentality. And you must hear from people who are presenting it properly. Right? And I remember last week, you know, I was listening to the different classes, Dandagranya Prabhu and Srinikavacha Prabhu and Gangaswara Prabhu, and very nice presentations. Right? So it's purifying. Right? You can't say, well, you know, they're not qualified, you know, they haven't got to the level of Shukadeva Goswami yet. You know, this is true. If, you know, we had to be on the level of Shukadeva Goswami, then we wouldn't be able to walk into the temple, right? It'll be lifetimes before we get to that level, right? But because they're presenting it according to the parampara system, they're not changing anything, and the mood is what is particularly important. When you present Srimad Bhagavatam, you present the philosophy of Krishna consciousness, you must present the proper mood. So the mood must be to renounce sense gratification. That has to be the mood that we preach in. When you preach in that mood, it is effective to the people who listen to it. But if you preach in the mood, if the audience can detect that you're too much attached to sense gratification, the potency won't come through. Right? So therefore, there has to be potency in the speakers. So the speakers have to become qualified. They have to become good disciples of their spiritual masters. And if they're strict followers and if they present things properly, the Bhagavatam has great effect. It is greatly purifying. So, we may listen to these things if we have the right attitude in listening and if the speaker has the right attitude in speaking. And it's interesting because when did Prabhupada present the Krishna book? Because the Krishna book was Prabhupada's summary study of the 10th canto. And Prabhupada completed that, and what year did they come out, the Krishna book? Prabhupada arrived in America in 1965. right? The first book he presented to us was Bhagavad Gita, in terms of the big books. You know, small books, easy journey to other places. But then, in the big books, Bhagavad Gita came, and then what was the order in which he presented the different books?
Nectar Devotion.
Nectar Devotion, yeah, it came out in 1970 also. Mm-hmm. 1970, right? Came out just after. Like, Bhagavad Gita came out, right? Then he presented first canon of the Srimad Bhagavatam. And I can't remember exactly who came first, but Teachings of Lord Chaitanya was there. And in 1970, Krishna book came out. And then Nectar Devotion came out not long after that. Right? So Prabhupada didn't know if he would finish the 10th canto. Right? And it turns out that Prabhupada finished the 10th canto up to the 13th chapter. So then he gave a summary study of the 10th canto, which is what the Krishna book is. It's a summary study of the 10th canto, because he didn't know if he would be able to finish it, and he wanted to give a bona fide commentary on the 10th canto in case he wasn't able to finish it in his lifetime. So he presented the Krishna book, and if you read these chapters in the Krishna book, Prabhupada quotes the Acharyas and he gives many arguments and he presents many arguments why these pastimes between Krishna and the gopis are not mundane. Right? Does anyone remember some of the arguments that Prabhupada presents? Why are these pastimes not mundane between Krishna and the gopis?
They're taking place between the Supreme Personality of Godhead and
yep.
the human being.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, that's a good point. What are some of the other arguments of Prabhupada? One argument that Prabhupada uses, right, that the Acharyas point out, there's nothing, because what is criticized here is Krishna's level of morality. Right? Is Krishna moral? Right, this is the question which people ask, especially in India, they ask, is Krishna moral? Right? He's in the middle of the forest in the middle of the night with unmarried women. Is that moral? No, it's not. So then it is pointed out it is moral, right? Because and the Acharyas give many different reasons. Because for one, who is Krishna?
In mundane vision, he's prepubescent, so he's not even.
Yeah, that's one of the arguments. Yeah, the Acharyas give. That's a good one.
He's supreme enjoyer and supreme controller.
Yeah, supreme enjoyer and supreme controller. In other words, he is the super soul. Right? So in one sense, he is the Purush. He is the Maha Purush. He is the Adi Purush. Right? He is the original enjoyer. What does Purusha mean?
Man.
Enjoyer. It's masculine. It means enjoyer. Right? And all of us, all of Krishna's Shaktis and Krishna's, you know, Krishna's Shaktis, his energies, are Prakriti. What does Prakriti mean? Yeah, feminine. That which is enjoyed. Right? So in terms of everyone in creation, all of us, we're all Prakriti, we're all feminine in the sense that we're meant to be enjoyed by the Purush, the masculine personality of Krishna. So therefore all of us, in one sense, are married to Krishna. Just like someone says to you, who's your husband? Right? Of course they can't say to you because you're a boy, but if they say to one of the Matajis, if they say, who is your husband? Right? You can say Krishna, right? And that's not incorrect. And even men, we can say, who's our husband? We can say Krishna. Right? And that's not incorrect. And some people may think, oh, well, that's, you know, that's weird. You know, you're a man, and you're saying your husband is Krishna. No, I'm Prakriti. And this is the point that you have to get through your head. We are Prakriti. You know, let go of your male ego. You know, I'm a man. You know, I'm a strong man. You know, I'm not married to anyone. And, you know, I'm especially not I'm not feminine. You know, I'm a man. Well, then, hey, let go of it. It's false ego. We are Prakriti, right? We are Krishna's feminine energy in the sense we're to be enjoyed by Krishna. And the reason we won't let ourselves be enjoyed by Krishna, and the reason we can't understand Krishna's pastimes, is because we hold on to our Purusha Bhav. Purusha Bhav means I am the enjoyer. Right? I am the enjoyer. Whether in a male form or a female form, everyone in the material world has this same problem. We think we are the enjoyer. Right? And as long as we think we are the enjoyer, then there's a problem with that. Because there's only one person who is the enjoyer, right? And he already reserved this spot. And he's reserved it for eternality. You know, he's already sat down on the seat and he's not going to get up. I mean, he does get up, but it's his seat. No one else is going to dare to sit on it. Everyone in the spiritual world, no one would dare sit on his seat. Right? Why? Because they understand it's his seat. Right? In the material world, or in material consciousness, we think we are meant to sit on his seat. So as soon as we get into that consciousness, he says, okay, you have to go to the material world, the reformatory center. Right? And when you get that out of your system, then you can come back. It's not a big deal. He hasn't got a big deal. Krishna's not all, he's not all angry and he's not all upset. He just says, you know, just go over there. Right? And when you work yourself out again, come back. You know, go and have your counselling, go and have your therapy. Right? And when you've got your head back together, right, and you understand who you are, then come back. There's no problem. Right? But at this point in time, all of us are in the material world because we think we are the enjoyer. Right? So the Acharyas point out, Krishna is the only enjoyer, and all of us are just Prakriti. So therefore, what is wrong with Krishna dancing with the gopis? They all belong to him anyway. They don't belong to their so-called husbands. Right? Another point the Acharyas point out is that the husbands are actually fictitious, or in some senses, they're only existing to give Krishna's pastime some form in the material world. Right? In the spiritual world, right, in Krishna's Goloka Vrindavan pastimes, there's no husbands actually existing. There is an abhiman. What is an abhiman?
Pride.
Pride, yeah.
Mental conception.
Yeah, mental conception. Right. An abhiman means a mental conception. So in the spiritual world, there's no actual husbands there. But the gopis have a mental conception, we are married. Right? But they're not actually there. You never see the husbands or anything. They're not there. But there's just this conception, we are married. Because then the parakeet rust can exist. Because they think, oh, we are married to someone, we must escape to be with Krishna. So the whole excitement of the pastimes continues, but there's no actual husbands. But when Krishna comes to the material world in Gokul Vrindavan, it is said that there are husbands who manifest in order to give the pastime some semblance of reality. Otherwise it would be very hard for us to read, you know, the pastimes of Krishna, and there's no actual husbands there. You know, Radharani had to escape into the night to meet Krishna in the forest of Vrindavan. She had to escape her mental conception of her husband. Right? So that would be very strange for us to be reading. Oh, she's trying to run away from the mental conception of her husband. What's that? So in the material world, Krishna manifests the actual husbands. Right? But the point is that the Acharyas point out the husbands are not actually, they're just part of the pastime potency. Right? The gopis never have any direct contact with their so-called husbands. And Prabhupada calls them like that. He says, so-called husbands. Just like, what is Radharani's so-called husband's name?
Abhimanyu.
Abhimanyu, right? And what does Abhiman mean? Mental conception. Abhimanyu is just a mental conception, right? So he's there. He manifests in the pastime. But there's no contact ever between Radharani and Abhimanyu. Right, there's no physical contact, there's no contact, it's just they're there, and sometimes he comes and knocks on her door, and she opens the door, and then she closes the door. You know, she opens the door, she says, Abhimanyu, and she says, oh, you know, and then just closes the door. She doesn't want to have anything to do with him. Right? She's not particularly warm and open and affectionate. She just doesn't want to have anything to do with him. And it's actually said by the Acharyas, Abhimanyu is actually an incarnation of Krishna's shadow. So Krishna's shadow becomes Abhimanyu, right? So he's just there to provide some pleasure for the pastimes between Radha and Krishna. But he doesn't actually... he is just a creation by Krishna to facilitate the pastimes. He doesn't actually have any direct contact with the gopis. So the Acharyas point out there's no direct contact there. In the Nectar of Devotion, there's one nice pastime given of how Krishna is always trying to meet with Radharani. And sometimes he even goes to Javat, which is the place where Radharani lives with Abhimanyu and Jatila, who is her mother-in-law and Abhimanyu. So sometimes she goes to Javat. Krishna goes to Javat to try to meet with Radharani. So he's very unsuccessful. He can't get to what he can't get to Radharani. As soon as Jatila sees him, she begins to shout, "Get out of here. You know, you black snake, get away from here. You know, who do you think you are trying to come and contaminate my daughter-in-law? Get out of here like this." So one time Krishna dresses up as Abhimanyu, right? And then he comes to the door and he looks like just like Abhimanyu, like her son. She says, "Oh, you're back early from cow herding today. You're back early." He said, "Yes, yes, yes, I'm back early and I've come to see Srimati Radharani in my day." He said, "I must go in and I have a gift for Srimati Radharani. I must go in." He said, "Yes, yes, yes, go in immediately. Go in and see Radharani." So then he goes in. On the way in, he says, "But be very careful. I've heard today that Krishna is on his way here and he's dressed up as me. So when he arrives here, right, be very careful not to let him in. He's coming to try and see Radharani." She says, "Yes, I will stand on guard." So she gets up above the doorway like that. So Krishna goes in, dressed as Abhimanyu, knocks on the door. Radharani opens the door, sees it's Abhimanyu, and then she says, "That's not Abhimanyu." Right? So then she opens the door and closes the door. So Krishna goes in with Radharani and the gopis, and he's having laughter and all sorts of pastimes are going on in there. And then Abhimanyu comes home. Right? So Jatila is up on the roof, right, and she starts throwing cow dung at him, like that, and pounding with cow dung, and he's being hit with cow dung patties like this. He's saying, "Mother, what's going on?" And she says, "Don't call me mother, you black snake. Get out of here. I understand who you are. You just come to contaminate all the girls. Get out of here like this." He said, "Mother, what are you doing? What's got into you today? Get out of here like this." So she gets a stick, she chases him away, so he goes running away. So how much pleasure, right, does Abhimanyu and the so-called husbands give to Krishna and Krishna's pastimes? They give unlimited pleasure to the pastimes. But they're just a creation by Krishna, a shadow, a mental conception which takes form. They never directly contact the gopis, but they just facilitate Krishna's pastimes. So the acharyas point out in many ways there was nothing mundane about Krishna meeting with the gopis. Another point that they make, which is important to understand, is that how old is Krishna at this point in time when he's performing these pastimes?
8 years
old, right? So 8-year-old boys and girls, especially in a pure culture like Vedic culture, they don't have material lust at that age. So the acharyas point out, he's only 8. Right? So if he's dancing in the forest with the gopis, it's not because of material lust. Right? It's a spiritual feeling. Right? It's a spiritual emotion. Right? It's a spiritual love. So they point out all these things, that, you know, he is actually their husband, right? Because he is the Supreme Lord, right? That the husbands don't actually exist, they're just there for the pastimes, and that they're actually at an age which is below lust. So it's made by the acharyas to point out that we should understand that Krishna's pastimes are not mundane, right? So we should not read them in a mundane way, and we should not read them for mundane reasons, right? And they should not present it like that. They should be presented in their pure spiritual consciousness, or in a pure spiritual presentation. That's the way they should be understood. And if we understand them like that, they purify the heart. Right? If you approach them with a material consciousness, lust will increase. But if you approach them with the right consciousness, then our lust will begin to disappear by hearing these pastimes. So we'll stop here and we'll see if there's any questions or comments on what we discussed. Yeah, some of the sages may not have been beyond the material modes yet. Right? It's not that all of them may have been beyond the material modes of nature. Some of them may have still been affected by the material modes to some small degree. So when they heard the pastimes, they may have, because they were affected by the modes, then they may have judged that Krishna was also. Or some of the sages, or many of the sages, were above the modes. They were transcendentalists. But for some reason, they did not have a pure conception of who Krishna was. So because their hearts were not purified by devotion towards Krishna, because some sages practiced on the ground, they had knowledge that the material world is false, but they hadn't developed towards Krishna yet. So because they didn't have the proper attitude towards Krishna, they thought Krishna was just acting according to the modes of material nature to some degree. So it means that they hadn't heard the Srimad Bhagavatam in the right consciousness. although they'd heard everything up until now, the nine cantos, but by the time it got to this point, because their consciousness was not correct in hearing, then they did not fully understand what was taking place. But those who understood, then they understand there's nothing material about these pastimes, it's pure, it's spiritual. Is that okay? Any other questions or comments?
The stages where they the devotional service they are doing to Krishna. Krishna is the enjoyer and he's always blissful and having all the what we can say opulences. So how can we justify the physical appearance of the sages that they present themselves as the most renowned? They don't eat much, or they just don't, they renunciate all the things.
Yeah, because some of the sages are very elevated personalities, right? Many of the sages are devotees, they're Vaishnavas. But some of the sages may be impersonalists. So it means that they've also, the common feature between the Vaishnavas and the impersonalists is that they both, if they're realized, they both understand true or false, and they understand spirit is real, is sat. But they have different conceptions of what spirit is. Some of them think it's Brahman, and some of them think it's Krishna. Right? So those who think it's Brahman, right, then they may not have been fully purified by hearing the Bhagavatam. But those who understand the absolute truth is Krishna, then they were fully purified by hearing the Bhagavatam. So even though they were actually free from material desires, but they didn't have the proper conception of the absolute truth. Not that.
No, the people who have the sages who have the right conception of the Krishna.
Yeah.
So Krishna is like a child and boy, and he's enjoying it, and he's having so many wealthy opulences, and the sages present themselves or tribal dancing, so on, that's why.
Yeah, because God does not contact the material energy, right? So Krishna has unlimited opulence, right? Just like how opulent is Vaikuntha, right? Vaikuntha is unlimited. Like you read in the third canto, when the four Kumaras went towards Vaikuntha, they passed through seven gates, entering into Vaikuntha. Describes how opulent Vaikuntha is. Right? Goloka Vrindavan is more opulent than Vaikuntha. Right, Vrindavan is actually more opulent than even Dwarka, right? But in Vrindavan, no one is particularly interested in the opulence. Sometimes people think Dwarka is more opulent than Vrindavan, because Vrindavan is like a cowherd place, more simple, and Dwarka is like a great palace, right? But actually, Vrindavan is more opulent than Dwarka. But the Buddha in Vrindavan is people are not particularly interested in the opulence. Very simple life, right, towards Krishna, like as a cowherd person. So, in Krishna's pastimes, everything is taking place in the spiritual energy. Krishna has no contact with the material energy. Therefore, when Krishna comes to the material world, he brings the Dharma with him. He brings the spiritual energy with him, because he doesn't want to contact the material energy directly. So the sages have renounced the material energy, but Krishna has also renounced the material energy, but he's not renouncing the spiritual energy. Like that. So he enjoys very opulently in the spiritual world, but it's spirit, right? It's sat, it's eternal truth, and it's meant for his enjoyment. So we also have to, that's why we dress very, as devotees, we dress very simply, we live very simply like that. I'm disinterested in the material world, but we want to be servants, we're interested in Krishna who is spiritual. Like that. Is that okay? And then if you serve the king, you get to enjoy all the facilities of the king. Just like, have a look at this place. I mean, has anyone in Melbourne got a bedroom like this, or a house like this? You know, no one's got a house as opulent as this. This is the most opulent house in Melbourne. So beautiful, this place, right? Because we're serving the king. So if you serve the king, you also get to live in the king's palace. But we should not think that the palace is for our enjoyment. If you think the palace is for your enjoyment, then problem. Prabhupada said, not one farthing, means not one cent, of Krishna's money should be used for our sense gratification. As soon as you do that, you begin to fall down.
Can I ask you something different from the effect of eating meat
yeah.
on the consciousness?
So what does it destroy immediately?
It destroys, the Bhagavatam says it destroys compassion. So it means if someone eats meat, then they lose their spiritual sensitivity, because they lose compassion, or they lose the ability to see someone as the soul and to relate to everyone as a soul. And you lose your compassion or your softness towards other living entities. Because the nature of Vaishnava culture, of Bhagavad Dharma, of spiritual culture, is that we treat everyone with respect, as every entity is part of Krishna. So therefore they're treated with respect. Right? If someone is eating meat, they can say, well, you know, we're very nice people and all that. I remember one time when I was a young devotee, I was preaching to a butcher. I was selling books shop to shop, and I was a young devotee, so I didn't preach to him very well. So I kind of said something to him. I said, more or less, you're wrong. And I said, no matter what you do, which is good, it's all bad. Well, that, which wasn't a very good way to preach to him, but you know, that's the way I was saying it. So it is true that even though, and he said, no, I'm a good person. You can't say I'm bad just because I'm a butcher. And I said, yeah, well, that's a fact, you are. And he threw me out of his shop. It wasn't a very good way to preach to him. I was only a young devotee, so it was immature. But the point is that it is a fact, actually, that if they are butchers, then they must have not part of themselves and compassionate to other living entities. You don't see things on the spiritual, because we see things on the spiritual level. That's the way Krishna teaches us in Bhagavad Gita. Pandit Samadarshana. You should see all living entities on the spiritual platform. So it means you wouldn't kill them. Like, would you kill a human being? You wouldn't kill a human being, so why are you going to kill a cow? Right? For us, we see them equally. Right? So therefore, you don't go and slaughter an animal, because then it will destroy your soft spiritual nature and your ability to give savor on a spiritual platform to offer respect to them. So therefore, it says in the Bhagavatam, you lose the quality of compassion. Right? And if you don't have compassion, then you can't develop spiritually higher. So even if someone's a very compassionate person, if they eat meat, then the compassion is not deep. It's not on the level sufficient to understand spiritual knowledge. Like that, so.
Is it right to call them Brahminos? They're very proud.
Yeah. Prabhupada actually says in that section of the Bhagavatam, the first canto, where Maharaj Pariksit chastises Kali, he actually calls it pride.
Mm-hmm.
Eating meat is a symptom of pride. Because I am so, you know, powerful, I can kill anything I want, I can eat anything I want. I mean, that's just pride. That if you're a little bit humble, then you'll say, you know, instead of slitting a cow's throat, right, I'll just take a carrot out of the ground. Right? Now, if someone's a little bit intelligent, understand you can't compare the two levels of, obviously it's violent to take the carrot out of the ground, but you can't compare the level of violence with killing an animal. You can't hear the carrot screaming or anything like that, but the animal suffers. So Krishna says, jiva, jivasya, jivanam, which means that every living entity must eat another living entity in order to live. That's the law of the material world. But Krishna says, as a human being, you're allowed to eat these living entities. Right? But when you eat them, first you must offer the food to me in the mode of goodness. The living entities must be in the mode of goodness, vegetables and grains and so forth. You offer it to me, I will purify you of the reaction, because there was some life taken, and then it's a karma. Just wait. Is that okay?
Yeah.
Just going to add, because there are inconsistencies. I mean, I do try and follow the regulative principles, but just to add Hitler and what's the difference, I mean, nothing for people.
Yeah.
So, you know, it doesn't necessarily mean if you're a vegetarian, you know, there have been many poor vegetarians as well.
Yeah, so the deeper point is that one should be, Prabhupada said we're not vegetarian, we are Christian alien.
Yes, Christian alien.
So it means that one should offer the food to Krishna, and that's what he, I don't think Hitler was doing that. Yeah, he was a vegetarian. But his problem was that it says that one has the swastika, that mark, which actually, that's actually Krishna's chakra. That mark which we have up there, and sometimes people walk into the prasadam and they say, oh, you guys are Nazis. Like that. We're not Nazis, that's actually the chakra, that's Krishna's disc, like that, that sign. But he was around. But it actually says one who carries that symbol before will be victorious in battle. Yeah, because you're carrying Lord Vishnu's symbol in front of your army, so you'll be victorious in battle because you're fighting on behalf of Vishnu. So he was taking the symbol thinking that I will be victorious, I will, you know, go around. But he twisted the whole thing. It was a twisted philosophy. It was based on him being God, the Führer. Right? The Führer means the emperor. That's what he was calling himself. Everyone was calling him the emperor. Right? So he was said to be a megalomaniac, which means he was so full of himself he lost contact with reality. So even though he was supposed to be a vegetarian, but he wasn't, you know, showing proper, you know, he killed 6 million Jews and nothing. Any other points?
Just to recommend for me, I think the Hindus, because they are, either they, like, it's in their face and they cannot get off, rid of their habits. And second reason is because they want to be strong. They think that it is more nutritious. So these are the misconceptions they have, and they are not aware that they are eating the matter only, because body is made of the five elements. They are talking on the material platform.
Yeah. So the point is that people are attached to eating animal fat, right? Because it tastes good, right? They taste flesh and it tastes good, right? Because it doesn't taste good for us, because we, you know, devotees are repelled by that kind of thing. But people, they taste the flesh, it tastes good, right? Because they're tasting the fat within the meat, like that. And it's the majesty of any flesh. And there's one conversation, they have not tasted human flesh yet.
Mm-hmm.
He said that is even sweeter.
Mm-hmm.
He said the time will come where they'll be interested in that. So the reason they're tasting is they're tasting the fat. So Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita that you're allowed to eat food, and he says in the Mode of Goodness, he says that is juicy, fatty, wholesome, increases the duration of life. So he says we're allowed to eat fat, but how do we get the fat from the animal? Then we take the milk of the cow. And then we drink the cow's milk and we turn it into curd, which is fatty, juicy, it's in the Mode of Goodness, like that. Or yogurt, or milk, or ghee, like that. And then we eat food like that, and that's where we get the animal fat. So we get the satisfaction of the senses, and we get all the benefits, but we don't have to slaughter the animal. So it's in the Mode of Krishna accepts that. That's okay. Any other questions? Okay, Srila Prabhupada.